And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Hurricane Dean is ripping through the coast of Mexico while the next big storm brews in the Caribbean. Meanwhile, floods are spreading their wreckage as they sweep their way through the Midwest in the late summer. Record-setting heat keeps people cooking in the Atlantic states while New Yorkers bundle up because they're too cold. What's with the weather these days? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What's going on with the weather? It seems like there are more big weather stories than I can ever remember. Serious flooding in Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana. Shelby, Ohio, reports the worst flooding since 1913. Record heat is stuck over the Atlantic states, as New Yorkers are bundling up against the record cold snap that's setting summertime low temperature records. Hurricane Dean took a Category 5 punch at the Yucatan with winds that peaked at 200 miles per hour, and it's ripping its way across the Mexican mainland, leaving floods and broken homes and villages in its wake. People I know are saying, well, it's due to global warming, while others say, this is just the way weather is. It's nothing unusual. Well, something feels different. Because for whatever reason it is, I don't remember so much trouble with the weather. It just seems like one major hit after another. But I realize, and I'm sure plenty of you are asking the same question, is it possible that the media is making the most of the spectacles of floods and hurricanes because disaster is a mega pull for listeners? Is this a real change, or are we thinking about weather more now because we see real live reporters standing thigh deep in the water or bracing against the gale force winds while house parts fly by? If it is just a spectacle of the 24/7 news cycle, okay. If it is the beginning of a long saga of more intense weather patterns, I think we'd better know. Because the real life stories of people in the deluge are beginning to sound frighteningly similar to the stories coming from Hurricane Katrina almost exactly 2 years ago. We'll be making that point clear when we talk with Donna Buckby from Rushford, Minnesota, who sits on a ridge overlooking the devastation that has taken out the homes and businesses of her friends in her town. And then we talk with Tom Downs of Weather 2000, a real live meteorologist, to hear what he knows about what's going on with the weather. That's coming up in segment two, but now it's time for the Weekly Earth Summary. Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and we begin this week's update with a late summer invitation by our favorite ethologist and animal behaviorist, Dr. Mark Beckoff, who gives you a short course in becoming a better naturalist. Dr. Beckoff?
People are outside during the summer, so I always tell people, take the time, take a few deep breaths, don't rush through nature, and watch baby animals, and watch parent-offspring interactions. So I was on campus a few days ago, and there was a baby squirrel, and the mother, and I suppose it was the mother, it was a female, was chasing it about, and they were playing. And then just yesterday, I walked up my driveway saying goodbye to a friend who brings her dog over to my sort of doggy daycare center, and there was a baby black-headed grosbeak just whining and screaming for food, and the mother wasn't around, and we got really concerned. And then a couple of minutes later, Mom showed. I've got baby violet-green swallows coming out of the eaves of my house, and they play and chase one another. So I always tell people, you know, you can go to a dog park and you can watch the dogs, but you can also watch the local animals, the birds and the little rodents. And so I tell them, you know, if you want to become an ethologist, take a pen and a paper like Conrad Lorenz and I do, and or film the animals. So I've actually got some kids looking at dogs playing at a dog park. Just being outside is a gift in and of itself, but being able to watch these phenomenal interactions, of course, is, you know, just beyond the beyond.
Dr. Beckhoff is in the process of writing an encyclopedia of animal behavior, and I'm anxious to talk with him about that when it's finished. Next, Dr. Matthew Sleeth shares his passion and love of the earth and love of its people in ways that challenge us to see and think in new ways. His book, Serve God, Save the Planet, has birthed just such a rethinking in the faith-based communities, and his mission expands every single day. He brings his unique perspective to the issue of wind farms. Dr. Sleeth?
Mostly, I understand people, even those who have opinions that are different than mine. Seeing a Hummer or some similarly oversized vehicle going down the road doesn't get me into an environmental rant, because I can understand somewhat the thinking of its driver. However, there's one opinion held by people that I simply can't get my mind around. It has to do with a form of technology that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. I have two paintings up in my living room. One is a painting that's 200 years old, and the other dates to 50 years later. Both are landscapes, and they feature this aesthetic piece of technology. Now all of a sudden, for the first time in history, people are against this technology. I say for the first time because it is a technology that I grew up with, and it supplied a significant amount of the energy to all the farmers across the country. My mother sternly instructed us not to climb on it, so of course I did. Its vantage point was mesmerizing, and its beauty proved irresistible. I'm talking about a windmill. A windmill, or a wind farm, is temporary. They will not last forever, yet the destruction they offset, such as mountaintop removal, is permanent. Once removed, a mountain will never heal or rebuild itself. The alternative to this clean, renewable power source is coal and nuclear and fossil fuel energy. I just visited the Maple Ridge Wind Farm in New York. It's the largest wind farm in the East with 195 turbines. It provides power for 98,000 homes and brings tourism and other clean industry to the area. The U.S. is about to see the widespread introduction of vertical axis windmills. Their profile is much smaller than the propeller blade type currently in use, and they operate more efficiently, thus requiring lower wind speeds. Perhaps they'll be more acceptable to people. I think what's needed is for serious artists, such as those who painted the windmills in my paintings, to focus on the charm of modern clean windmills. Perhaps in the future, they can come to have the charm and appeal that another technology has. That subject of art also rises into the air and comes from ancient times. I'm talking about the lighthouse. Maybe what's needed is to combine the two for complete acceptability. Perhaps even the people off the coast will enjoy this form of technology and art in the future.
Thank you, Matthew. And speaking of revisioning our future, Carl Pope, president of the Sierra Club, cuts to the chase when it comes to who's leading the way to the changes we are all coming to understand must occur sooner than later. Carl?
First, the city's got it. More than 600 signed up as cool cities, committed to cleaning up greenhouse pollution one city at a time. Now the counties are stepping up to the plate. King County, Washington executive Ron Sims signed up America's mega counties, 12 jurisdictions representing 17 million Americans. Each of these counties committed to the Sierra Club's 2% solution. Reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by 2% a year until by 2050, they're down by 80%. The counties range from Shelby in Tennessee to Queen Anne's in Maryland, Cook in Illinois, Alameda in California. The American public is clamoring for action to tackle global warming problems and fix our badly broken energy policy. County leaders understand the seriousness of the problems we face, and they are taking the kind of bold, visionary action that will protect both our climate and our citizens. As Ron Sims observed, we no longer have time to waste. We know what it takes to reduce CO2 emissions, and we owe it to our children and grandchildren to make the tough decisions and right investments now.
Thank you, Carl. Ben Lowe is an emerging voice that speaks on behalf and for the new environmentalists whose lives will feel the impacts of the changes we speak of regularly, and as you'll see, he's becoming just a little impatient with the progress so far. Ben?
I woke up this morning and saw some very hopeful news. President Bush is calling for high-level talks at the end of September 2007 with 15 of the world's leading economies. He first proposed this conference in May, and the stated goal is to agree on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I'm not too young to be completely naive. This conference is likely in large part a political move to appease climate campaigners ahead of the upcoming elections. The current administration is probably still not committed to making big enough cuts needed to tackle global warming. Still, it is important to celebrate this long overdue first step. Thousands of scientists, leaders, and students have been fighting tirelessly to overcome misinformation campaigns and promote responsible climate action by our nation. They have been an inspiration to many, and we are seeing the first fruits of their labors. But we must not become lax now. This is only the first easy step on a long road, and if anything, we need to continue ramping up our efforts to solve this crisis before it is too late.
Thank you, Ben. To track what Ben is working on, visit www.arocha.org. That's www.arocha.org. Dr. Charles Kennell speaks with authority and power on the wider global challenges we face as we try to define a new global dynamic, not only of the natural systems, but as well, the human systems. Dr. Kennell.
One of the things I think that we should realize is that right now the world at large is beginning to reap all the benefit of the advances that society did make in the 20th century. There's been an enormous increase in global prosperity, particularly in India and China, but the world is gradually being transformed. Our most modern advanced things of 20 years ago, these economies are developing unbelievably rapidly. And this is, on balance, a good thing. The human welfare, clearly, is advancing at a tremendous rate. And it was the Western nations that led the way and taught the way on how to do that. We were profligate in our use of resources in accomplishing these goals, and we didn't find the most efficient path to accomplish them. But we know enough now, and we're going to learn even more, I think, as we undertake our own responsibilities as advanced nations, do all the things that you suggested, reduce our footprint, become more efficient. Those things we learn, we can't hoard. We have to give it away as quickly as possible to the developing world and hopefully help them find a more efficient path to prosperity than we did. If we could do that, then we would have several of the components of a sustainable society in hand, a smaller environmental footprint, greater prosperity, equity, and justice. So and there really are three problems, of course. There's the advanced nations and what they have to do to reduce their footprint. There are the developing nations that are on a path towards greater human welfare, and our job there is to make their path more efficient and have them arrive at sustainability faster than we did. And then I think there's a collection of the most vulnerable nations, where I think they're not developing the capacity rapidly enough to deal with the problems that climate change will bring them. And you can point to some of them. I mean, people worry about floods in Bangladesh, for example, and some of the African nations have people very worried about their ability to actually cope with the climate change that the developing and developed nations are going to bring to them. And so I think there's a special problem with the most vulnerable nations. but many of the developing nations, one hopes that they will develop the capacity on their own to cope with their environmental footprint, and that's the goal with them. So there really are three problems. Finally, sort of both ethically and from the point of view of global social stability, I do not believe that we can end up with a global society in which there's vast pockets of poverty and inability to cope.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. I want to thank our regular guests who visit with us each week. They bring a strong diversity of ideas and opinions, but share a common goal, and that is to unite our efforts to save life on Earth. Be sure to tune in each week during the first segment to hear the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Because in order to chart the path ahead, you'll need to know the changing terrain. There's no doubt that change is in the wind. Bob Dylan captured an earlier time when he sang, "You don't have to know the weatherman to know which way the wind blows." To which I say, with all due respect to the great Mr. Dylan, the times they are a-changing. As we get ready to ask the weatherman about the wind, the rain, and more, when your voice of the earth continues, here, on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, let's face it. It's getting a bit weird outside. It's been one weather-related disaster after another, with tornadoes in New York City, another close call with the season's first hurricane, with plenty more on the way, and now, flooding in the Midwest as school starts? What's next? We really need to know, because this is hitting a lot of us pretty hard. We take a personal look at one town hit hard by flooding in Minnesota and get the latest weather report for the long term from a real live meteorologist when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. What is going on with the weather? Are things getting weirder? Or are we just feeling the unending drama laid out to us live and in living color from hurricanes, floods, and tornadoes and more that seem to be happening almost nonstop these days? Following the news, we head up to Minnesota and talk with Donna Buckby, who has had to watch helplessly while her southeastern Minnesota town prepares to clean up following a massive flood, or wait until they see what the next squall may have in store for them as rains are predicted to come again. Then it's out to New York to talk with Tom Downs, a real live meteorologist with Weather 2000, about what is happening with the weather. If you've wondered about that yourself, then you'll definitely want to stick around. That's all coming up. But first, this week's Nature News. Weather is making the news as Hurricane Dean crashes through the Yucatan and smashes across the Mexican mainland. Floods rampage through the Midwest. Heat grips the Atlantic coast and, well, we'll be covering these in depth following the news. Next time you get ready to plant some vegetables or ornamentals from a seed packet, be sure to check the status of the hardiness zones, those colored strips that tell you when it's appropriate to plant your particular favorite. Seems people whose business it is to draw those boundaries have had to take it into their own hands to determine how the climate shift may be affecting those zones, and according to Woody Nelson, Vice President of the National Arbor Day Foundation, those boundaries are moving quickly. Relying on fresh data between 1990 and 2004 from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the changes are startling. Many areas jumped one or two zones higher. The climate has changed, Nelson said. It's warmed. To learn the results of their findings, go to www.arborday.org. I'll give you all the details here, /media/zones.cfm. I'll spell that whole thing out, www.arborday.org/media/zones.cfm. What can we say? All these dire predictions of the melting of the ice sheets by 2100 or so appear to be wrong. Way wrong. Based on current data, the ice sheets are melting much faster than even some of the most extreme predictors indicated. Sea ice generally remains in the Arctic region long into the summer. Computer models had predicted that a complete melt of the Arctic sea ice in summer would occur by the year 2070 to 2100. Scratch that. Predictions now are that this could happen by 2030. And in a related story, the Antarctic is disappearing at a much faster rate than had been anticipated, leading scientists to say that a reasonable prediction of a 3-foot rise in the oceans by 2100 is more accurate than the 16 inches previously predicted. And that's where things are now. Some predictors indicate that that number could be closer to 6 feet. Time will tell. And looking at it from another perspective, water officials have been warned to get used to drought. Concern over climate change is increasing in the West. Over the past 8 years, the Colorado River has received just over half of its average flow. The river provides water to areas of Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. The NRDC, which sponsored the study, says that immediate programs of water conservation are the best first step to begin addressing the growing threat to drought-stricken communities. Under the direction of the new director of the Bureau of Land Management, long-standing protections to public lands have been stripped away, clearing the path for more efficient, frequent, and extensive development of America's public lands. James Caswell, the new director of the BLM, recently appointed by President George Bush, has recently handed down a decision which, if approved, will categorically exclude various projects, such as the use of the 60,000-pound thumper trucks to pound the earth on the quest for oil on public lands, with no public review. Historically, such categorical exclusions were applied to such things as mushroom hunting and Christmas tree cutting. Welcome to the new Public Lands Agency. And a recent study of 80 North Puget Sound marine bird species reports that their numbers are in serious decline. Some less scientific voices may say they are in trouble. Referring to studies done in the 1970s, populations of one bird species, the western grebe, would average thousands of birds. The recent studies reported numbers ranging from 10 to 436. Other birds in decline include the common murre, long-billed black and white seabird, whose population has declined by 93%, and the long-necked black and white seabird, which has seen its population decline by 81% in the last 30 years. Generally, one can conclude from this week's news that the global system is in radical transformation that will predictably see the disappearance of birds, animals, and plants common to humanity for thousands and thousands of years. as well, it will see, as it has in the last 2 weeks from flooding in India and Bangladesh, the forced relocation of tens of millions of people. Scare tactics? Nope. And that's the news. It's fascinating to turn on the evening news every night or any time of day and to see the extraordinary images of what's happening on this planet, particularly the hurricanes and the storms. Weather seems to be dominating, and the flooding as well, which I find so odd in the middle of summer, late summer. I sit here in the grandeur and pleasure of living in San Diego and watch all of this because we don't seem to have these kinds of things happen, but it is happening. It's happening to real people. And that's what I want to investigate right now. So we're heading off to Rushford, Minnesota, and talking with Donna Buckby, who's right in the middle of some of the big floods that are happening there. Donna, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah, Donna, you live in Rushford, Minnesota. Where's that?
Well, it's in Houston. Well, it's Fillmore County. I live in Houston County, southeast Minnesota.
Southeast Minnesota. Give us a little sense of what that terrain is like.
Well, it's very beautiful. I moved down here in 1975 from the Twin Cities because of the beauty, but it's hundreds and hundreds of valleys and ridgetops and valleys with rivers running down the valleys. Rushford is in the valley between two big hills, so it's very beautiful, the Root River, the Rush River.
You're very fortunate. You live a little bit remote.
Well, I live about 6 miles out of Rushford. I'm on a hilltop. So when the rain started, I knew I was probably going to be okay and the road might wash out. We had a drought, and then the rain started a few weeks ago. And then we thought, well, thank goodness the drought's over, but then the rains never stopped. So the ground was saturated for the last week or so, and Saturday night, Sunday morning, Rushford got 8 inches of rain. And hearing that rain and knowing the duration of it, I just laid in my bed thinking, oh, my God, people are going to be in big trouble, and animals are going to be dying. But anyway, Rushford, the worst part for Rushford was on top of the 8 inches of rain they got. Up the watershed a ways, about 10 miles away, there was over 18 inches of rain during the night. And that all came down Rush Creek and the Root River and just blew through the town.
From what I understand, you're a little bit stranded yourself.
Well, the road washed out, the easy road washed out, but there's a back way to town. So I took that the next morning and to see what had gone on in Rushford, and you couldn't get to the town. You could stand on the bridge and look, but there was water throughout the town. And during the night, I guess the air raid went off, and they were evacuating people, going door to door, and taking people out of their homes on boats. And you could still see the people on the boats. They had to take supplies to the shelters. By boat, because even the shelters were surrounded with water.
How deep would you estimate the water was in the town in its deepest areas?
6, 7, 8 feet. It was up to the rooftops in some of the areas, and in the trailer park, which was a very low area, low lying, it was up to the roof.
That's real devastation.
Yes, it is. And the wells are contaminated, the septic system backed up, the gas stations were covered up and with water, and so they are saying that Rushford is now just a toxic septic sewer.
Where have I heard that before?
New Orleans.
Aha, almost yeah. 2 years ago to the day.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, amazingly enough, this is sort of like a mainland Katrina to the people of Rushford.
Well, yes, it is, and in fact, when I went to the shelter today to put my name on a list for opening my home to people who need a place to stay. And there was a woman there who was very supportive of me and a group of friends who went down to New Orleans a couple of years ago. And her daughter went down, and she said, you know, is this strikingly like New Orleans? And I said, oh, yes. Oh, yes. So people, that is not lost on the people of this town. And sadly, also like New Orleans, so many people, businesses and homeowners, had no flood insurance. And, you know, I'm not saying that a lot of people in this area said such things about the people in New Orleans, but I've heard a few comments, and it was victim blaming about the people in New Orleans, that they should have left, or if they didn't have flood insurance, they were fools. So there were some victim blaming comments made in the area. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of people, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of very charitable, hardworking, caring people in this area, of course.
This is one thing I'm curious about. You've been in Rushford, up on your hillside there, for 32 years. Have you ever experienced this kind of storm before?
No. There have been floods. The river has flooded, and there's a floodplain. So the valley floor is wide and can accommodate the Root River flooding. There are levees in Rushford and levees in the city of Houston, which is just downriver, about 11 miles from Rushford. But I have never seen anything like this, not this amount of rain. And 30 years ago, there was maybe a 10 inches of rain that fell, and they said, well, this is the 100-year rain and 100-year flood. But for 18 inches to fall in one night, no, I've never seen anything like this. And the town of Rushford hasn't seen anything like this.
Mm. How much of the town do you estimate to be really affected by the storm?
There are hundreds of homes that are ruined.
What do you think is going to happen? In areas like that, you have a lot of people who've lived there for their entire lives. They've, in many cases, inherited their homes from families that go back generations. Some people are retired. You know, it's a special community. What's the population?
It's about 1,500.
It's a small town.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because particularly if people don't have flood insurance, what's going to happen?
Well, I heard the president just flew over. And I'm hoping there'll be some low or interest-free loans and grants to help people open up their businesses again. But I don't know. I think people are just wondering that also. People in Rushford are wondering, what is going to happen to me?
Now, you're planning to go down and help. What do you hope to do for your neighbors?
Well, probably the same thing we did in New Orleans, and that is muck out homes and businesses, and I guess that's going to be it.
You know, one of the strange things, you've got a winter coming somewhere down the road here. These people, what are they going to do?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do. Winter is coming, and it feels very scary.
Do you have any information on if people want to help, what they might be able to do?
Yeah, you can call the Red Cross, and if you feel like donating to them, and designate it for Southeast Minnesota or Western Wisconsin, which also got hit pretty hard. Now I'm hearing Ohio, other places. But I just also want to say that Minnesota has had a bad time this summer with the bridge collapsing up in the Twin Cities. And for me, we need to raise taxes to maintain and invest in our infrastructure. It's an honor to do that for the common good, and we just have to confront Pawlenty's vetoes. We need to raise taxes.
Well, I just heard a commentator say in European countries such things are considered an investment in our future, and here it's considered an expense and an extravagance. It's a matter of priorities.
Yes, absolutely.
I may call you in the weeks ahead here and see how things are progressing and see what we can do.
That's fine. I would love to talk to you again.
Okay, well, we're talking with Donna Buckby, who's in Rushford, Minnesota. Good luck.
Thank you.
I have to wish Donna and all the residents of these storm-torn towns throughout the Midwest and down in Texas, and who knows where next, some means of finding their way through these very difficult times. I only hope somehow a better sense of response has developed since our last most devastating big one, Katrina, which has hardly begun to get back on its feet after 2 years of bureaucratic and greed-drenched nonsense that has destroyed much more than the homes and neighborhoods throughout the Gulf. For people's hopes are now disappearing as well. Someone do you wrong, yeah. Got love as good as gone, yeah. Maybe you ain't as strong as you wanna be. It's alright if you don't wanna go home. It's alright if you don't wanna be alone. It's alright if you So I get up this morning and I turn on the news and it's just totally inundated with stories again about weather. It just seems like weather has become one of the most amazing and captivating stories in the media these days. As we speak here, Hurricane Dean is beginning to pound the Mexican coast, and as well up in the Midwest, in Minnesota and Indiana and Ohio and places like that, there's incredible floods, and we've had heat waves. Anyways, what in the world is going on? It's as if this is it's the deluge. Something's happening, or maybe it's not. And that's why I want to talk with our guest who's joining us now from New York. We're talking with Tom Downs, who's with Weather 2000. Tom, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Hey, nice to be here, Sydney.
You're in New York, and we're hearing that people are complaining about it being so cold. What's going on?
Yeah, well, yesterday we had a high of 59 degrees here in New York, and that is actually the coldest daytime high in New York City history. In August, I should say, which is the result of just being inundated by some rainfall. We're in the north side of that frontal boundary that is causing all the warm air in the southeastern United States. And, you know, it just so happens that we were sucked in there with a marine layer that a lot of people there in California are used to. Just was a pretty dismal day, and we just never climbed out of the 50s.
But that's odd. What was your low?
It was 56, I believe.
Oh, you're pretty tight then.
Yeah, so it was pretty tight. It was all the result of a rain, and there was no sun for the last few days. And, you know, it's just a freak situation, essentially. But
yeah.
Like it never happened before. It happened way back in 1913, or 1911, I'm sorry. We tied the record set back then. So it happened a long time ago, but it just doesn't happen very often.
Here's my question. We're hearing about so many stories of record heat, possibly even drought, certainly the storms that are happening in the Midwest and causing flooding in the middle of August. Of course, the hurricanes are pretty standard. But my question to you is this what's been going on and off for the last, you know, 1,000 years, one way or another? Or is this some sort of new trend? And that's what I'd like to explore a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, first off, you know, we can start talking about what's going on now and get people interested in the weather. I mean, obviously they are. It seems like the weather is the most sought-about topic with a lot of media personnel because it's something that we all experience. I mean, there's nobody that doesn't experience the weather or, you know, of some sort or the other. So when we go to extreme weather like hurricanes, you know, the media jumps all on that because it's something that very few people experience, but people can relate to it just because of the damage, the human toll, and the fatalities. Unfortunately, there are some, but, you know, a lot of times you look out and there's very few fatalities with Hurricane Dean on Jamaica, for instance, because they were so prepared in advance.
Right, exactly. One of the reasons that weather is so predominant is the fact that it's raw drama, and it's live. Many of these people are standing out there, and we're feeling their pain.
Exactly. I mean, at this stage, a couple of days ago, we were talking about seeing how many reporters and TV reporters you can fit in Montego Bay on Jamaica. It seems like, you know, there's a society is saturated with the media just with all the internet avenues and not only the internet, but cable news and regular broadcast news. There's a lot more avenues of media outlets that can reach people, and more people are paying attention to what's going on out there, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it can also distort in our minds what's normal. Because after all, we always hear what the normal temperature or the normal precipitation is for a certain location at a certain time of year, but we always have to remember that normal is the average of the extremes. And unfortunately, that could vary from place to place, and you can have a location like Seattle, which doesn't get too cold or too warm, but then you can get to a place like International Falls, which can reach up to the 90s and get down to the minus 40s in the summer, in the wintertime. Depending on your location, you know, normal is the average of the extremes, and that can mean a whole lot of different things for different places.
Well, we're experiencing radical heat here in San Diego with 80 degrees and 80% humidity. So we're all sweating and complaining. But I lived in Minnesota where I can recall 99 degrees and 99% humidity, and that was not fun at all.
No, I mean, you know, just also humidity is something that makes things unpleasant. And when you're talking about extremely humid conditions, it just makes you know, the perception of how bad it is even worse. And unfortunately, for the areas right around the coast, this time of year, the water temperatures are the warmest, and that tends to bring the most humid conditions, especially here on the East Coast, where we're talking about waters offshore that are in the 70s, where they're normally much lower, And when you get down into the Gulf of Mexico, you're talking about mid to upper 80s for some of the water temperatures. And that just makes things worse and puts more moisture into the air and makes those temperatures feel even worse than they are. For example, Key West, you know, has a typical low of 84 every night because they're right on the water and it's water temperatures are in the mid and upper 80s. So it doesn't allow them to cool off that much. And same thing goes up here in the East Coast and also down in San Diego there. That area, the waters warm up this time of year, and it's not like up in Washington on the Pacific Coast there that the water's temperatures stay in the 50s most of the year.
Well, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to do a little exploration because actually we're talking about different weather phenomenon. We're kind of talking about hurricanes. We're talking about rain. We're talking about heat. We're talking about cold and water temperatures. And there's a relationship between them. But I'd like to kind of explore these from a historical perspective. One of the things about weather people is the fact that they're like sports fans. You guys have it's all about records, you know, trends.
It's about records and it's about averages and it's about statistics.
It's so funny. Right now, these rains are in the news so much. My question would be, historically, particularly, let's say, in the Midwest and Texas, and is this normal? Have these things happened on a regular basis and we just tend to forget? Or is there a new trend that's developing?
Well, a lot of times, it's, you know, the media also portrays an event, and they look for the most extreme value that's in a particular region. So if you talk about Victoria, Texas, they've had, you know, they're about 30 inches of rain above normal for the year, which is an extraordinary number of extraordinary amount. However, if you look at other places, yes, they're wet, but they're not sopping wet like they are in Victoria, Texas. Same thing goes in the Midwest. You know, there's some places with a lot of drought that are right next to areas with a lot of rain right now because there was drought, and a lot of the rain fell on that dry land. Instead of the soil absorbing that water, it just ran off and pooled into the areas where flooding can occur. And that was, you see that a lot of times out in Las Vegas, when you have maybe an inch of rain causes widespread flooding, not because there's a lot of rain per se in absolute terms, but because relatively speaking of what that area experiences, that ground can't absorb the rain and causes a flood. So a flood here in New York, you have to have, you know, 4, 5, 6 inches in a day a lot of times or in a couple hours for it to really be newsworthy like we had a couple weeks ago. But, you know, other areas like Las Vegas, they only need about half an inch to an inch of rain to screw things up there.
So what you're talking about is kind of the squalls that come through and are very regionalized in terms of the amount of rain in a short period of time. Is there something that's indicating that this is changing compared to, let's say, the 1950s or 1960s or 70s? Because I just don't know. I don't have that the memory to recall if these kinds of floods and events were regionalized.
Sure.
But let's talk about frequency or whatever you can share.
Perfect segue. I just think that climate science deals with looking back into the past and trying to make sense of all the all what's happening with the weather. So climate is an average of all the weather. So you go back and looking at the climate. And if there's periods and cycles that go around in the weather. For instance, out west, it's been pretty dry the last decade almost. Prior to that, there was a little bit of a wet period, and prior to that, a little bit of a dry period. So it seems like every 10, 15 years or so, there's a reversal out west from the Rockies to the coast. Unfortunately, we just seem to be in the driest stretch of that in the last few years. But, you know, weather works in cycles, and I'm sure that in the next few years, somebody's going to start talking about how wet everything is down in the Southwest. Similarly with hurricanes, I mean, that's a perfect example. Hurricanes tend to go in cycles. So from World War II to 1969, there was an active hurricane period where we had many strong hurricanes. Camille in 1969 was an example that devastated the Gulf Coast and Mississippi. And then we had a little relative lull of hurricane activity. There were only a few storms every year. And that really culminated itself up until 1994. Aside from Andrew and Hugo, the two main storms of 89 and 92, those areas all the way from the Texas coast to the Maine coast really had very few storms to worry about. But then a magic switch turned on in the climate system that in 1995, we're seeing an increase ever since then of storms, hurricanes, and a lot of other results from that, flooding, rain, and high winds. So just it seems like there is cycles in weather, and just that's an example in the last 100 years or 75 years of just two cycles that seem to be prevalent across the United States.
Well, people who do the research certainly attribute a correlation between sunspot activity and weather. Is that part of what we're seeing right now? Because the sun is in accelerating in terms of its activity right now.
In terms of the long climate regime, sunspot activity and solar activity does add some heat to the atmosphere. However, as far as on a shorter-term basis, from year to year or maybe a couple years to every couple years, sunspot activity and solar cycles don't have that much of a role in our climate system. It's just that over a long term, maybe 500 years or 200 years, the sun's decreasing or increasing in solar output may cool or warm our climate by a certain amount. And a lot of those studies are getting published because there's the debate about global warming, about whether it's happening and what the reasons are why it's happening. And as a climate scientist, you know, global warming is definitely happening. However, you know, reasons for it are not necessarily up for debate. 90% of scientists believe that global warming is caused by, at least in part, by humans. However, there are both natural and human elements to consider there.
Climate science is perhaps one of the most difficult sciences in the world. That's why they have the big Cray computers and others
exactly.
that have to try to figure this stuff out, and it's become quite an elegant art. And yet, when you really look at the large picture, I don't know that anybody really has figured it out yet.
You know, it's so complex. There are so many, you know, one example that's always given is can chaos theory. It's always the butterfly flapping its wings over Florida causing a tornado in Texas. You know, it's that's obviously an extreme example, but whether that, if that butterfly didn't flap his wings, would that air particle not have moved in a certain direction and caused some spinning 100 or 1,000 miles away? The climate system is so complex and there are so many different variables to consider, from snow and ice to rain to drought to heat to cold. And, you know, hurricanes and also are part of that climate system. And when we're talking about such a wide variety of variables, it creates a lot of confusion among the general public, but also scientists themselves in trying to get what their research findings are out to the public.
Well, you actually said something that I find very useful, and that is you said that there's no doubt that that global warming is occurring,
mm-hmm.
and I think most people would tend to agree with that. Then I'm trying to find out if these are some new trends. Are the storms becoming more intense, more frequent? You know, obviously, if there is an overall change in the climate, this will be manifest in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of rain, do you, just from your gut or from what you're hearing, do you sense that there is some sort of change in the style and nature of rainfall these days?
Well, I mean, pretty much you go back to the basics and say in a lot of the theories that are out there with global warming, theory is a term in science that is used to indicate not something that is a guess or a hypothesis, but it's something that is established based on scientific facts and derived from different facts. So a theory is that there's going to be a lot more humidity and precipitation in a warmer world. In the back of our minds, you start to think, well, is this event associated with global warming, or is this event not associated with global warming, or is it a combination of both? And pretty much it's hard to pinpoint one event like a hurricane or a storm over the Midwest or this extreme drought over some sections of the country to global warming. However, there will be a trend in the long term that indicates that more of these events are happening, as you quite are aware. However, it's going to be over 10, 15, 20, maybe even 40, 50 years before you can actually take a look back and actually confirm all of the warming trends or cooling trends or rainfall trends or drought trends. That's what makes it so complex.
It's funny. It feels, and because I follow this and so many other people do and the media does, that, you know, it's almost like we're being led to believe somehow that the end is near, that we're in the last days. That's what I'm trying to get a handle on here, because everyone's talking about the weather, you know?
Yeah, the important thing to realize with any talk about global warming and relating it to individual weather events is that it's almost like the El Nino phenomenon in the Pacific Ocean. Everybody wants to blame El Nino for everything. Everybody wants to blame global warming for something because there's always a desire to blame something. And unfortunately, a lot of times things just happen that there's no real blame that can be assigned to it. And that's, I guess, part of human nature. We always want to put a finger on or to blame something or someone for their situation. However, a lot of times with the weather and climate system, it's just chance and random variables that come together to make our weather that we see and feel on an everyday basis.
Maybe this is the question I need to ask, because I have one of these minds that won't won't quit until I'm satisfied sure, that I've gotten the answer. Okay. As we look back, we're witnessing all these floods. I can recall some big rains and some floods in the past when I was in Minnesota, for example. Have these kinds of floods occurred at this time of the year in the past? That's my question.
Well, you know, one year that jumps out at me is 1993 when we had the Mississippi River flooding that was really extensive from Minnesota to Iowa and down into Illinois and Missouri.
That was extraordinary.
Yeah, that was extraordinary, and that stands out in my mind and as well as a lot of people's minds. And, you know, right now we're having a lot of floods in the localized areas, but a year like 1993 quickly reminds us that an extended period of rains in the spring and the summer can really, really affect a wide area of the country, and especially when you're talking about a basin like the Mississippi River covers a lot of states and a lot of areas that are susceptible to flooding from that. So 1993, that's one example right there of extreme flooding that what we're seeing in the last few days is nowhere near the duration and the intensity of what we saw back then.
How about heat? Certainly some areas of the country are talking dramatically about what they're referring to as a drought. And we've had droughts before. Does this seem to be sort of a normal pattern?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's two different climate patterns that are really established across the U.S. You know, one is a seasonal rainy season, a dry season, which typically is associated with the western U.S. And hardly anyone from all the way up and down the west coast from Southern California up to Seattle, they hardly see any rain during the summer months. And it's all the winter months that get most of the rain. So pretty much there's always a cycle of drought every year in those areas. However, you know, it's those year-to-year droughts and how much precipitation you get during the rainy season that really, really matters. As you can imagine, the West is more reliant on yearly precipitation values, and that has manifested itself over the last decade or so in extreme drought in the West. But back east here, a lot of the drought is on a month-to-seasonal basis and not necessarily a 6-month to 12-month basis and a decadal basis. So areas in Tennessee and Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina had exceptional drought this year, which is helping to fuel some of the extreme temperatures. For instance, Atlanta today just hit 100 degrees for the ninth time in August, which is a record for a single month, but also ties the record for the number of days that it reached 100 in the entire summer season. That's it. That's an example of extreme weather just in the last few days, and remarkably, all that's happened pretty much in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, now also you have these repeating records, in other words, frequency of record-making, that some people are suggesting there's a trend, particularly as it relates to heat that way, that we're now setting a series of records over a short span of time, as opposed to before when you'd have maybe 20, 30 years or whatever that span might be. Does there seem to be a trend that's suggesting that we are having more frequent extreme weather that's kind of ganging up in a short period of time?
Well, a lot of times weather just manifests itself in a persistent, what we call as meteorologists, persistence. It's a pattern that lasts for multiple days and possibly weeks on end, that once you get stuck in that pattern, it seems like, you know, whenever you break a record, you're more likely to break another record because you're in that pattern of extreme weather conditions. But then you may take a step back and not experience something like that for a few years again and not have that ability to break the record for a while. For instance, you know, one other thing that with records, especially high temperatures and low temperatures, that we see more high temperatures now and in terms of record highs in the cities because of a lot of urbanization trends. Maybe people have heard the term urban heat island and how the urban areas are much warmer than the surrounding suburbs and rural areas.
That's a new one for me, urban heat island.
Yeah, the urban heat island, the urban heat island effect is, you know, is a phenomenon that really manifests itself in the city versus the surrounding regions. And the urban heat island, concrete and asphalt replaced what was once sand or parkland or grassland. And when you take out the grassland and the vegetation in the open space, you wind up heating the surrounding areas more because you're letting it absorb into the concrete, which doesn't emit and cool off as much as the vegetation would.
Well, you know, that to me begins to define an aspect of what could be termed global warming. I mean, just as a practical application,
right.
As we replace the natural systems with these human-made heat sinks that hold that will tend, as you say, to create an urban heat island, which therefore becomes an unusual heat zone in an otherwise natural area. And we don't know what the effect of that would have, but it would be changing patterns of weather conceivably.
Sure, especially what we notice, because most people live in cities by definition. Cities are the most populated areas, and what most people feel and experience are those warmer temperatures at night, especially when we don't break those records. We no longer in New York City routinely get down below zero, which we did in the 1880s and 1890s, not only because of weather patterns, but because our weather stations here in the city were in parkland and in farms. There's not a farm that can be found on Manhattan right now, as everybody probably realizes. And, you know, that's something that changes with urbanization. The good thing, though, in terms of the global warming studies and relating it to the urban heat island is that scientists have already thought of this, and a lot of the stations that scientists are using to determine whether global warming is happening or not are rural locations. So they're not necessarily impacted and influenced as much by this urban heat island effect. And that's one important aspect that some people miss, that a lot of the global warming is happening in areas outside of the major metropolitan areas, which typically measure our temperatures and have the longest historical records based their assumptions on.
Now, let's also talk about, I know that growing up in Minnesota, and I'm going to have you validate something for me, because every time I say this to my friends, because when they talk about cold, and then I say, well, I grew up in Minnesota, and I know what it's like to hit 60 degrees below zero, their eyes roll around, and they say, no way. I'm right, aren't I?
Well, in terms of wind chill, I mean, just this past year, and this past winter, and places in Minnesota got down actual air temperatures down into the minus 40s. And near minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and you know you just need a little bit of wind to stir things up and to make that wind chill down to minus 60. So yes, it is possible for you to experience minus 60 degree weather or feeling of minus 60 degree weather in Minnesota.
Well, this was actually a temperature of minus 60. I'm going to have to go back in the records, but I'm pretty sure I recall minus 60. And I'll tell you something, that is something you don't want to be around.
No, that's a definite, and it's very dangerous. And, you know, cold is just as dangerous as heat a lot of times.
Oh, it's amazing. The question would be, I do recall that, or something close to that, let's put it that way. But a lot of people are saying it just doesn't get as cold as it used to. Any indication that that is changing through time, that we're just not hitting those lows like we used to?
By the way, just as an aside, you know, the lowest all-time temperature in Minnesota was minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit on February 2nd, 1996.
There you go.
So
that's
a perfect example right
Thank
there.
Thank you.
I just found that within a couple minutes of doing some research.
But okay, conversation over. That's all I wanted to get to. No, okay, go ahead.
In terms of cold, yeah, I mean, one thing that we always bring up here in New York City is that from not last winter, but the previous four winters, we saw 40 or more inches of snow back to back to back to back. And that had never happened in the record keeping in New York City before. So you can't even go back, 50 to 100 years, and that never happened before. So cold and snow is certainly not out of the question anymore. It's just that our perceptions of where cold and snow, certain locations can get locked into a pattern over years or decades. You know, another phenomenon out west is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which a lot of fishermen take a look at too, to figure out where the fish are going to be, and salmon migration patterns across the Pacific Northwest. But also, that's a very good indication of what temperatures are. And when we're in a positive Pacific Decadal Oscillation pattern over 20 years or so, you're going to have more warm winters and more warm summers. If you do it the other way, like in the past, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, there was more of a negative phase, which was more conducive to these cold air outbreaks. So, in essence, it's based on what kind of patterns you get stuck into, not only on a yearly basis, but can be even 10, 15, 20-year patterns that persist. And we just happen in the United States, especially in the West, to be in one of the warm cycles. Back east here, we have a lot of cold this past winter, and a lot of cold has been happening over the last 10 years that maybe didn't happen back in the 90s and the 80s.
Changing systems at all levels. This is one that should be definitively recorded, and that would be, and this relates directly to the hurricanes that are occurring, because as we hear the stories, the hurricane comes in and it hits the warm waters of the Gulf and begins to really fuel the power of that hurricane. Water temperatures, any trends on that?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's one that should be fairly well documentable and also indicative of larger change. What's happening in terms of water temperatures?
Well, water temperatures, ironically, are a very difficult thing to put your hand on. Everybody lives on land, and there's a lot of places, a big sample size of locations on land. However, over water, you really need a buoy or a ship or something to pass over it to get the information and to record temperatures. However, you know, since the 1960s, we've had the fortunate technology to have weather satellites in the atmosphere over the Earth looking down and trying to estimate temperatures of the water. And since 1980 or 83, or I believe that the magic year is, we've had sea surface temperature satellite imagery that have been able to pinpoint temperatures throughout the globe in terms of water temperatures.
You're keeping us hanging. So what are we finding out?
We're finding out that it's hard to really put a handle on something that's only 25 years worth of data. So, you know, over the Atlantic basin, which gets the most attention in the Gulf and in the Caribbean with hurricanes, we're just happen to be in that cycle of warmer water temperatures that's really started about 1995 and has lasted for the last 12 years so far, and can last another 10 to 15 years. Prior to that, there was a cold water cycle, and that manifests itself in not only hurricanes, but some of the different wind patterns and precipitation patterns around the tropics and around the Atlantic basin.
Well, it's a fascinating realm. So down to the bottom line here.
Yes.
As we watch these stories, what should we take from them? Are we seeing a sort of new weather patterns, or are these just repeating patterns that have existed before?
Most of the weather that we've seen has existed before someplace on the planet. It's just a matter of us observing it and trying to put a handle on what the frequency is. Sometimes our human minds get carried away, and everybody wants to say it's extreme because that sells advertising in the media. However, you go back and you take a look at some of the weather that's expected in the future due to global warming and other climate change processes, that there may be extreme weather conditions, but I just don't think we've observed too much of what is lies ahead.
There you have it. We've been talking with Tom Downs, who's with Weather 2000. He's talking to us from New York City, where they're going through an extraordinarily cold couple of days here. Tom, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Sure, my pleasure, and don't hesitate to call again.
Thank you so much, Tom.
All right, you're welcome.
So now, I get to weigh in on the question of what's happening to the weather. Personally, I think we're witnessing a trend to more intense and frequent weather events, be they rains, heat, cold, storms, hurricanes, windstorms. But the most important thing to take away from this is that somehow our societies must begin to factor in such environmental change into our formula for the future. And in particular, a means of helping those whose lives have been smashed against the vagaries of global warming, so that they can be restored to whatever remnant of wholeness exists when their homes and the belongings and friends and family are gone. A new sense of globalization must be found that realizes that it is the actions of the many that are brutalizing those unfortunate millions whose lives will continue to be hit, likely from now on. We need to find a way to shift from an economy based on the bottom line to a global sense of compassion. As we plan and hope for energy independence and a reduction of global greenhouse gases, we need a system of compassion credits to accompany the carbon credits as we offset the good from the other. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.